I will officially welcome everyone to today's Clue and Internet Seminar on Conducting Contamination Assessment at Dry Cleaning Sites, which has been sponsored by the State Coalition for Remediation of Dry Cleaners. My name is Jean Balance, and I work here in EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. We're going to cover a few basic housekeeping and reminders to give our participants a few extra minutes to hop on the line before we officially kick off the technical presentation. As I mentioned earlier, you should have a copy of today's presentation materials in front of you. They can either be accessed from the seminar homepage by clicking the Go to Seminar button. On the seminar homepage, you could read a complete description of the event, look at our contact information for instructors as well as their bios, as well as download today's presentation for future reference. You could also save it as a PowerPoint or PDF. Everyone should be looking at the slides and should be on slide number one, which is the title slide. I'm going to ask that everyone move past slide number one onto slide number two, where I'll cover some basic housekeeping items. As I mentioned, for those of you who are on the phone lines, we have globally muted all of the phone lines to minimize disruptions. We would ask that you keep yourself on that global mute, so do not unmute your line until we get to a designated point for Q&A, which has been reserved at the end of the formal presentation. At that time, you'll be able to hit pound six to unmute your line, but again, I ask do not hit that command until we get to the point for Q&A. Keep yourself on the global mute until then. And I thank you in advance for your cooperation with that. If you need to hang up, you can certainly hang up and dial back into the line at any time. There won't be a disruption. We don't want you to put the call on hold. There could be music or other commercials that will be disruptive. So again, just stay on global mute. If you need to leave the call, hang up. You can dial back in without disrupting us. Again, we are taking questions at the end of the formal presentation. When you are asking a question, we would ask that you try to indicate what slide number or speaker was covering the material to help us best or most easily answer your questions. Again, we're going to hold those questions until the end of the formal presentation. For those of you that are not on the phone lines and are streaming audio online through your computer, you can actually use some of the icons that appear along the top of your slides to help you navigate through the materials as well as submit questions or comments at any time. Again, we're going to hold the questions, but at that designated time at the end of the session, I will read out loud the electronically submitted questions and comments on your behalf to the presenters for them to answer. So if you're looking for assistance to move through the materials, if you're looking at them online through a web browser window, you can use numbered links that appear on the left side of your screen, or you can use the arrows that appear along the top. So the single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide, the single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. Our presenters will be indicating when to move to the next slide, as well as the slide number, so you should be able to follow along manually by moving through the materials at their verbal cues. If you have questions or comments, again, we're holding them until the end, but we would encourage you online to type them up at any point so that we have a queue and we can get through the questions as quickly as possible. If you click the question mark icon that appears above the top of your slides online, that'll open up a new window where you can actually type up your question or comment. And again, when we get to the break at the end, I'll read them out loud on your behalf to our instructors. You can also use that same question mark button to report technical difficulties. If you're having any problems, just be sure to include a telephone number where our support staff can reach you so that we can get in touch with you to troubleshoot whatever your issues may be. One final reminder, today's entire session will be recorded. Again, we have a huge demand to participate today. We're expecting an audience turnout of 500-plus people. If someone is unable to get in or you know of a colleague that wanted to join you but could not, this session will be available for free download and replay on Clue in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. All of you, as well as those of you on the wait list, will automatically receive an email with that link to download or replay the session, and you are welcome to forward that information as soon as it's available to colleagues or people that you think would benefit from this session. And I think that is the end of my formal reminders for today's presentation. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number three, and I will turn things over to Bill Lynn from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection.
Thank you, Jean. Everybody, welcome to the State Coalition for Remediation of Dry Cleaners webinar on conducting contamination assessment at dry cleaning sites. Before we get into the technical presentation, I'd like to tell you a few things about the State Coalition. So please turn to slide number four. We were founded in 1999. We're sponsored by the EPA, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Our advisor is Mr. John Quander with the EPA, and we'd like to thank EPA for the opportunity for presenting this seminar. Our current chair is Scott Huffstedt of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. We currently have 20 participating states. 13 of those states have dry cleaning solvent cleanup programs, and the states outlined in red on the previous slide, slide number three, are the states with the formal programs. Our mission from EPA basically is to share information that we've learned on working on these sites, both assessment information and remedial information, and that's the intent of this seminar. We have a website, it's at the bottom of the slide, www.drycleancoalition.org. If you've never been there, I urge you to go there. There's a lot of information and a lot of links. If you now turn to slide number five, our website, which we're real proud of, has a centerpiece of 175 dry cleaning site profiles. These are 175 sites where remediation has been conducted at contaminated dry cleaners. That has a lot of hydrogeological information, a lot of engineering design and performance data, some cost data on many of the sites, and lessons learned. There's a number of papers that are available for download, and one of them is entitled Conducting Contamination Assessment Work at Dry Clean Sites. That was updated last year, and that is, this webinar is an outgrowth of that paper. Another one that may be of interest is chemicals used in dry cleaning operations, because we simply do not have the time to get into a lot of details in this webinar. Linked with that is a dry cleaning chemical database that has over 600 chemicals that are or have been used in dry cleaning operations, and you can search that by chemical name, trade name, and CAS number. We have a virtual tour of a dry cleaning operation that has a lot of pictures in it, and you can walk through that and see the equipment and the processes. Related to that is a basically a virtual regulatory tour of a PCE dry cleaner that talks about all the regulatory issues associated with PCE use and PCE waste. If you want to know more about terms used in the industry, we have a glossary of dry cleaning terms. We also have numerous other publication and links, and we have a newsletter that comes out twice a year, and you can subscribe to that. We also have contact information for the members. Before we start the technical presentation, it'll be divided into four different parts. Part one is on the dry clean process, and that will be presented by Don Hansen, who is a PG with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality in Eugene. I'll follow Don and talk about waste generated in dry cleaning operations and historical waste management practices. Following me will be Terry Evanson, who is a professional hydrologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in Madison, and her topic will be site reconnaissance and sampling. And batting cleanup will be Steve Hoke, a professional geologist with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in Trenton, and his topic will be assessment techniques and equipment. And when he's completed his presentation, we'll turn it back to Gene and open it up for questions. So now I'm going to turn it over to Don Hansen, the Oregon DEQ, and please turn to slide six.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, everyone. So we're on slide number six, and I'm going to be talking about the dry cleaning process. And let's just move right along to slide number seven. And basically, what my goal here is to basically lead you through a dry cleaning facility from when the clothes are brought in to when they're packaged and shipped out and all the steps in between. And on this slide, I basically have just laid out some of the processes that go on in the dry cleaning shop that we're going to be hitting on today, that I'm going to be hitting on today. And then the other speakers later on are going to be coming back to some of these processes where some of the wastes are generated and where we may want to do assessment when we're assessing these sites for contamination. I do want to mention that we're going to be talking about active dry cleaning facilities where they dry clean in the shop there. Everyone should know that sometimes you'll encounter what's called a drop store or a clean store where they don't do any dry cleaning at the current time. And in those cases, those clothes are basically dropped off there and then shipped to another location, and then they're cleaned there and then they brought back to the drop store. It's important to remember that a lot of drop stores were at one time operating dry cleaners. So just because you have a drop store, don't stop there. You might want to do a little bit more digging. Also, I'm talking about manned facilities where there's people working in the shop cleaning the clothes. I'm not talking so much about coin-op dry cleaners. Terry's going to get into coin-operated self-service dry cleaners a little bit later, and it's important to keep in mind that there's these different types of shops, but we're focusing here on these next few slides on a classic in-shop dry cleaning operation. And I, again, go back to at the bottom of this slide, the website for the SCRD, and the virtual tour here at our website, it will give you even more information about the actual process that goes on, and I think you'll find that very interesting. So let's go ahead and move on to slide number 8. And then you should be seeing a map, a very rough sketch, schematic. And basically, this is just a kind of a typical dry cleaner that we encounter, you know, in the field, and some of the locations that the equipment are typically located in, and some of the things you might want to be aware of. You'll see down at the bottom of the slide the front entrance. There's generally a counter there. Then there's basically clean clothes are stored on racks. You probably are familiar with that, and we'll see a picture of that in a minute. Behind all those clean clothes is where most of the action takes place as far as pre-cleaning, the actual dry cleaning, and all the infrastructure for the shop. Some important items to keep in mind are where the sewer exits the building. Because a lot of times water or waste, PCE-containing material may go down the drain, basically, the sewer. And so that's oftentimes a source, and Terry and Steve are also going to be talking about that in quite a bit more detail later. You'll see that there's shops on the each side of this facility. So this is a kind of a typical strip mall set up, and there's a lot of dry cleaners in strip malls, and I just threw in a couple of typical tenants that I've run into, and you know, a nail salon on the right, and then a daycare center on the left. And daycare centers, I can tell you, are more problematic, because then you're obviously running into child exposures and whatnot. So we're going to go ahead and jump to slide number 9 now. And this is just a picture of the typical front counter area of a dry cleaner. Basically, what's going to happen here is this is where you drop off the clothes. They give you a ticket, and then they're going to tag them and take them back. Up at the front, right behind the counter, they may do some pressing up there. But generally, it's just going to be a retail type setting with you'll see a lot of the clothes behind there. And again, if they take the material, if they ship some of the clothes off to other areas, they may put them in bags for shipping off to other cleaning facilities. Okay, now we're going to move on to slide number 10, pre-cleaning or spot cleaning. And when your clothes go, before they go into the dry cleaning machine, if they have stains on them, they're going to be pre-cleaned, which is sometimes called spotting. And what you see in these pictures here on this slide are spotting boards. They look kind of like ironing boards, but they have a vacuum underneath, and then they apply chemicals that basically are pulled through the clothes to remove stains. And it's important to keep in mind that chemicals other than PERC, tetrachloroethylene, are commonly used for spot cleaning. You can have any number of solvents, TCE, they can use PCE, 111 TCA, and others. And here, important to keep in mind that when you're doing an assessment and you run into some other chemicals that you wouldn't expect, it's a, you know, it's a perk cleaning shop, and you start seeing some weird detections of chemicals that aren't related to perk, it may be from this process. Okay, now we're going to move on to slide number 11, and here again I'm going to talk a little bit about the solvents, and this presentation is mainly about perk or tetrachloroethylene shops, but this slide goes through some of the history of the solvents used in the dry cleaning industry over time. Generally, earlier in the history, into the early 1900s, petroleum-based products were used. In the 50s, basically, they started transitioning into using tetrachloroethylene or PERC. Stoddard solvent was used up until the, it was the most common solvent used up until the 1950s, and it's still used. And you'll see on here there's some other chemicals that you might not think are associated. And here I go back to my previous slide when talking about spotting. You might be detecting some chemicals that aren't related to PERC that still may be from that facility. And again, at the bottom of that slide, there's a link to the SCRD chemical used in dry cleaning operations website, which has way more detail than this slide. Okay, now we're going to skip on to slide number 12. And this slide basically just introduces my discussion about the dry cleaning machines, how they've changed over time. And basically they called these different generations of dry cleaning machines. And basically these dry cleaning machines have evolved over time to improve efficiency, to improve safety, to reduce the number of releases to the environment. And then I'm going to go into this more on the next slide, which is slide number 13. And here you've got, starting at the bottom of the slide, your first, what are referred to as first generation machines or transfer machines. This is where the clothes were actually taken. It's like you do at home. You put your clothes in the washing machine. When they're spun, you take them out and you put them into the dryer. That's what a transfer machine is in the dry cleaning industry. They're basically, those have been phased out for PERC by 2008. Moving up after the transfer machines, they call those second generation machines or the dry-to-dry machines. So they're basically, it's all done in one machine. Put the clothes in, they're washed, and they're dried all in the same machine. Moving into the third generation machines, these are the first machines where they have refrigerated condensers to recover the solvent vapors. And this type of machine is pretty commonly still used today. Getting up into the top of the slide, the fourth and fifth generation machines, these basically have refrigerated condensers and carbon absorbers to help remove remove more of the solvent from the air, recover more of the solvent in the process. All right, now we're going to move on and look at some of these machines on the next slide, which is 14. You should be on slide number 14. And at the top of this slide, you'll see a couple of pictures of some old transfer machines. The one on the right is a belly washer machine, and that one actually didn't even spin. The little vertical unit on the left in that upper right slide is an extractor. So the clothes would have been washed in that belly washer and then put in that extractor to spin dry, and then it would have been dried in another machine. The two machines on the bottom, those are more typical modern, what we would call a dry-to-dry machine. And these are just, these dry-to-dry machines are going to have various, depending on the generation that they are, they're going to have various amounts of environmental controls and solvent recovery controls. And on the next slide, number 15, I just want to mention that, you know, there's a lot of movement now in the industry to get away from PERC, and a lot of people call these new machines green machines. They use non-chlorinated solvent. Green Earth is an example of a proprietary chemical-based liquid silicone product that is fairly common. These machines are quite a bit more expensive than an older dry-to-dry machine, and they're quite a bit more complex. And you'll see at the bottom picture in that slide, the front of the machine looks pretty similar to a standard dry-to-dry machine, but these machines are quite complex if you look at the back side, which is pictured on the top of that slide. All right, now we're going to move on to slide number 16. And now I'm going to just briefly talk about actually what goes on in the dry cleaning machine when the clothes are put in. Basically, the clothes are put in after they're spot cleaned. They're charged with mostly solvent. There's a little bit of water and surfactants and detergent that goes in also. They're washed. Clean solvent is added while the dirty solvent is removed. Then the solvent is drained and it is extracted. Then it's filled and rinsed. This is pretty similar to what you're used to in your home washing machine scenario, except that getting down towards the bottom, the clothes are dried in the same machine. The door is not open generally. We're talking about a relatively modern machine here. And the solvent-laden air is sent to a condenser to remove the solvent. And then the cool air is then circulated and then before the drum is opened up. Okay, that's the what goes on in the washing machine. Now we're going to talk a little bit about what goes on besides the washing on slide number 17. And I like to think of this as there's a wet, in dealing with the solvent recovery and solvent clarification, there's a wet side and an air and a dry side. There's the liquid solvent, and then there's a solvent that is in the air. So basically what happens with the solvent that's being used for the washing, obviously it's becoming dirty. It's picking up dirt and lint and all kinds of junk from the clothes. And so it needs to be filtered, and then it needs to be distilled to separate out that junk that is taken out of the clothes. On the air side, down below in that slide, basically there's a refrigerated condenser that removes the solvent and water from the airstream. And then the solvent is removed, returned to the cleaning system. And then there's a carbon absorber used to remove solvent from when the drying cycle is over. And I should just mention that a lot of effort is taken to recover the solvent because it's pretty expensive, and a lot of states have taxes on the solvent because to fund their cleanup programs and things like that. So there is quite a bit of effort and incentive to recover solvent and not just throw it away nowadays. If we move on to slide number 18, it's just a schematic of this process, the dry cleaning process, and I'm not going to run through this in detail. I will just kind of point out that the top side of this schematic, in the middle, you've got the actual dry cleaning machine where all the action takes place. On the top side, it's the solvent loop cycles, the various parts of the clarification process of the solvent. And then on the bottom side, you've got your vapor loop. And you can look at those different steps there. And we're going to be talking about some of these parts, such as the distillation unit and the filters. Okay, so we're ready now to move on to slide number 19. And on slide number 19, I just have a couple of pictures of some cartridge filters that are used to remove junk from the solvent. And some of these are just paper. Chemical impregnated paper. Others have like a clay material, a clay core. But these cartridge filters are generally going to look like this, like what you would kind of expect a cartridge to look like. Some of these, there is another type of filter which Bill is going to talk about, which is a spin disc filter. that uses filter substrate like diatomaceous earth or clay materials to remove even more impurities from the solvent. All right. I think we're ready to move on to slide number 20 now. And here I'm going to talk about the distillation of the separate, to separate the solvent and the water. And so basically the picture on the left side on the bottom is a picture of the backside of a dry cleaning machine's distillation unit. We're going to be talking about this quite a bit today. Basically the solvent and the water, any kind of material, you know, the solvent and any water is going to be distilled and then recondensed to separate the water and the solvent. What's left behind is called still bottoms. Bill's going to be talking a lot about that. That's in the blue bucket in the left-hand picture. That black stuff in there is still bottoms. The white bucket on the left is where the what we call separator water is going. And that separator water can certainly contain PCE, and the still bottoms are absolutely going to contain PCE. That separator, what happens to that separator water is pretty important because depending on the age of the facility, when it was used, you know, it could have gone down the drain or it could be treated. And the picture on the right is actually a water treatment unit that is designed for treating separator water. And that treatment unit has carbon filtration, and then and that's run on compressed air. All these dry cleaners generally have a compressed air running through the facility. You'll mention, we'll talk about this later, but that this treatment system on the right actually is sending treated water to the roof for it to be atomized and a mister. And Bill's going to talk about that a little bit later. And Terry, now the picture on the distillation unit on the left there is part of the dry cleaning machine. Sometimes the distillation units were standalone machines, and Terry's going to be talking about that later also. So now let's move on to slide number 21 and talk a little bit about the condensation to remove the solvent from the airstream part of the process. And basically a chiller or condenser condenses the water and the solvent to a liquid form, and then the solvent and the water are separated in a solvent-water separator. The solvent is then rerouted to the cleaning system and reused, and the air, after the solvent is removed, is routed back to the machine, and it's often run through a carbon absorber to remove the PCE out of the air. These are all pictures of these various components of the dry cleaning machine. All right, moving on to slide number 22. This is just a picture of a cabinet dryer. This is another piece of equipment that is probably not going to be much concern for you in your assessment that you may see. And this is for just for drying things like sweaters that can't be tumbled. So let's move right on to slide number 23. We're getting into the finishing process as the clothes are almost done here. And these presses, you'll see various all kinds of interesting looking equipment for shirts, and these are steam presses generally. The steam is recovered in a vacuum unit. The vacuum unit also collects the solvent from the spotting boards typically. And that vacuum unit is will obviously contain some level of PCE sometimes, and a lot of time that just drains to the floor drain or out through a drain through the building wall or something like that. So that's something to think about in doing your assessment. One other thing to consider, if the if you determine that your facility that you're investigating did waterproofing, a lot of times that was done with a dip process where PCE or another chlorinated solvent was used as a carrier for waxes and things like that, and that's something to be concerned about. I don't have any pictures of that, but just something for you to keep in mind when you're looking at what went on in a cleaners. And then moving on to slide number 24, basically we're at the end here. Closer package, they're ready to be picked up. And I just wanted to remind you again, talking about cleaners where the work is done in the shop here and not coin ops, and we'll be talking a little bit about more about that later in the presentation. But right now, that's the end of my presentation, and I'm going to hand it back over to Bill Lynn, and he's going to be talking about the waste generated during the dry cleaning process.
Thank you, Don. There have been big changes in dry cleaning in the last 30 years in this country, and those changes have been driven by basically two pieces of regulation. The first one was the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which was promulgated in November of 1980, which regulates hazardous waste. And the second one were the amendments to the Clean Air Act, which were promulgated in September of 1990, which made PCE a hazardous air pollutant. So if you turn to slide number 26, we're going to talk about these different waste streams that are generated in dry cleaning operations. And if you go into a modern-day dry cleaner, you can study those waste, but if you don't look at what they did in the past, then you could be in trouble because you may be working on a facility that's been open for 40 or 50 years. The current operator likely doesn't know much, if anything, about the past waste management practices or the equipment or where it was located. So in dry cleaning, the past indeed is the key to the present. So we're going to talk about still bottoms and cook powder residues, spent filters and filter powder, separator water, mop water, vacuum water, lint, and waste solvent. So please turn to slide number 27. Some of these pictures are the same. We're, still bottoms and cook powder residues are both waste products generated by the distillation process. So the dirty solvent is heated to boiling and vapors come off, and those vapors have solvent and water primarily. Any other compound whose boiling point is less than what's being run, which with a PERC machine is about 190 degrees. Everything left behind is either a non-volatile residue or water or solvent. And that waste product for the conventional distillation unit on a PERC machine can have up to 75% PERC by weight left in it. Muck is a spent powder filter, and we'll talk about that later in more detail, but it's these powder filters, they use diatomite, which is diatomaceous earth, and or they use activated carbon. Material generated, the muck, in the distillation unit, the muck cooker, it's a particular kind of unit. It's more solid. But if you look at the one on the left, the still bottoms, if you've ever seen that, it reminds me of Turkish coffee. It's like dark brown and it's fairly dense. The muck can have up to 50% by weight PCE in it in a PCE dry cleaning operation. So go to the next slide, please. Separator water is one of the byproducts of the distillation process. On the left, you see the 5-gallon white bucket, which they collected in, and unattended, these buckets have been known to overflow onto the floor, and if you don't have secondary containment, this is the source area you need to look at. Separator water is saturated with respect to solvent, and If you're ever in a PERC dry cleaning operation, go over to the separated water bucket and swirl it around, and oftentimes you will see little globules of PERC. The biggest one I've ever seen is about as big as my fist. So you can have considerable PERC free phase in that bucket. So in addition to being saturated, it can have free phase. And once you see that free phase in there, you begin to understand how a lot of these facilities became contaminated over the years. Now, what did they do with that stuff? If you look on the picture on the right, you see a steel bucket with coils in it, and those are heating coils. There's steam that's running through those. And if you look down in the bucket, you can see that you've got boiling water. So one of the ways that traditionally have gotten rid of this stuff is just to boil it off or to evaporate it. Next slide, please, which will be 29. The International Fabric Carrier Institute, which is now called the Dry Clean and Laundry Institute, which is the largest trade group in the dry clean industry in the United States, did a equipment and plant operations survey in 1988. So that is 2 years after small quantity generators were required to report, required to notify, because of the solid and hazardous and solid waste amendments to RCRA. And in Florida, what we see is this is when, 1986 is when most of the dry cleaners signed up to a hazardous waste hauling service. So this survey was taken a little less than 2 years after that happened. Anyway, they had 909 respondents to this survey, and they were in all 50 states and Washington, D.C. And one of the questions they asked him is, what do you do with your separator water? And here's what their responses were. So most of it went to the sewer, and then a little bit of it went to the septic tank, if they were on a septic tank. Some of it was discharged with other waste, and they didn't really specify what that meant, and then other, and that we'll see what some of those uses may have been. So anyway, the sewer line is an important place to look during these investigations. Go to the next slide, which is 30. Now today, well, what we see in Florida is most operators have a separated water treatment unit, and Don talked about these, and you see the two basic models up there. The one on the left, you see the two carbon filters, the white units mounted on the side, and these are like the carbon treatment units that you can buy at Sears to put under your sink. And the one at the right, there's carbon in the cylinder, and then there's a carbon unit mounted, a little white one outside. The one on the left, you pour the separator water in the top, and then it goes down through the two sets of carbon filters. There's a little free-phase knockout where you can recover free-phase PERC. Then you can either evaporate that in that machine, or you can dispose of it by other means, assuming you have permission. The one on the right, and we see many more of these than the evaporation units, because you do not need electricity to operate this. After the separator water is filtered, the treated water is forced up through tubing through an atomizer that's mounted typically at near the roof line on the outside of the building. A couple other uses for separator water. Some of them still use it as for pre-spotting and cleaning operations. It's also been used to mop floors. So if you're ever in a dry cleaning facility that has tile floors and the tiles are peeling up, that's probably what they did, because it will dissolve the cement behind the tiles. Please go to slide number 31. All right, this is one of these misting units mounted near the roof line on the outside of the building. And the problem with separator water treatment units is that the operators buy these and they never change the filters. So we call this the new contaminant source at dry cleaners. So it's worth looking at during your investigation. The problem with the atomizers is that they scale up after sometimes a short period of time, and if you don't maintain them, then instead of putting off a fine mist in the air, they actually drip, or the water will shoot out. And if you don't change your filter, then you're essentially discharging water that is saturated with respect to solvent. So it's important to know where these things are located. Slide number 32, please. All right, we're going to talk about the powder filtration system and Spence filters. And these are waste products of filtration, which is one of the solvent clarification processes. Cartridge filters, which came in 1960, are still the most widely used filters. Powder filtrate systems were the earliest systems, and they came in the 20s, and there's been various systems used, but what it involves is depositing the filter material on either a bag, a screen, a metallic wire mesh tube, and then we'll talk about spin disk in a minute, and then pumping the solvent through the filter material and through the screen or bag, where the non-volatile residue and solids and various other things that are found in the dirty clothing will plate out or be caught, and that's the purification. The spent filter material for this process is called muck, and it contains a lot of solvent in it, and some operators have distilled that, some have not, and they've discarded that, and we've got instances of these old facilities that use powder filter systems where they discarded the muck out on the ground behind the facility. Now, the newer systems are these spin disk filter operations. Please go to the next slide, number 33. At the top, you see the cartridge filters, and they come in various sizes. Basically, they're a perforated outer metal shell. Inside that is some pleated paper that's chemically treated. And inside that is either activated carbon, and those are the standard cartridge filters, or they'll have a mixture of activated carbon and activated clay. And the activated carbon filters primarily takes out fugitive dyes, and the clay takes out a number of different compounds. And they tend to be favored by the petroleum dry clean operations because many of the petroleum dry clean operations do not perform distillation because you need a vacuum still. You need to operate your distillation unit under a vacuum. So they just use the cartridge filters. On the bottom is a cutaway diagram of a spin disk filter. And the new machines are primarily spin disk filters, and they use some cartridge filters to do polishing. But the spin disk filter, there's a hollow axis that you see, and there's a series of disks mounted on this hollow axis, and they're covered with polyester. And the solvent comes up through, it's pumped through the polyester material on that axis as the filter. And then it goes down into the horizontal axis, and they'll periodically, as the waste build up on the outer part of the disc, they'll shut the solvent pump down, and then they'll spin that horizontal axis, hence the name spin disc, and the centrifugal force will throw off the waste to the bottom of the unit, and it'll go down into the distillation unit. So you see on the left side a little wheel, and that's hooked to a drive pulley, and that's where you spin it. You can operate these also with powder filtrate material, and you deposit that in there, and it builds up on the outer part of the polyester disc and acts as a filter. So those operations will generate more waste. But the reason these are in the are the favorite filter systems is you don't have to deal with all the big cartridge filters. It's waste. Next slide, please, which is slide 34. So what you see there, the green tubes are filter housings, and these house cartridge filters. The cartridge filters are placed in there end-to-end. There's a whole series of them in there. And in between, they have felt gaskets, and at the end filters, they have felt gaskets to seal. One of the things that can happen with these, if you don't change them often enough, the material that's filtered out of the solvent will build up on the outside of the filters, and the pump pressure will rise, and eventually you can have what's known as a blowout, and that is what's happened here. And you see on the ends of the filter units there, the material that's been deposited out there where it's leaked out. There are other things that can cause this, like too much moisture in the system or dry cleaning a lot of clothes that have been waterproofed, or not putting the gaskets in when you change the filters. But you also notice if you look at the floor that there's no secondary containment on that filter system. And so that's a source area, or a potential source area to look at. Next slide, please. Mop water. This is the overlooked waste stream at a dry cleaner. And if you mop the floor at a dry cleaning facility, you can actually saturate the mop water with solvent. And so you may ask, how can that happen? Turn to slide number 36, please. Looks like the last place you'd go to take anything to be cleaned, but this is the behind the dry cleaner, dry cleaning machine at a Florida dry cleaner. And it looks like it's black, but it's dark brown material on the floor, on the bucket, on the side of the machine, and splattered on the wall are still bottoms from the clean out of the still. If you mop this, you will saturate the mop water with solvent. And if so what do they do with the mop water? A lot of it goes down the floor drain. Some of it goes out the back door. If there's a storm drain right near the back door, look and see if you see any lint in there. If you do, you ought to sample it. You ought to sample it anyway. Sample the sediment, and if there's any standing water in there, sample that. Next slide, please. 37. This is a vacuum unit that Don talked about. So it's a tank, and on top of it is a small vacuum pump. This vacuum unit collects spent or condensed steam from the pressing operation, and also spent steam from any pre-spotting or pre-cleaning from the spotting board. The water doesn't contain much in it. The clothing that's been dry cleaned will have residual solvents in it, and then you press it on, or you put it on the pressing machine, and there's a pad that you lay it on. In that pad, if you've ever looked at one, it has little small holes in it, and when you activate the press, there's a vacuum pulled on those holes, and that vacuum pulls in the spent steam, and it's routed to this vacuum unit. And if you go into a dry clean machine, a lot of the piping that you see overhead are steam lines. And you also see at the base of this unit there's a little red spigot, and there's a container down there where periodically somebody draws off the water. At a PERC operation, the PERC concentrations in vacuum water, some people call it press return water, is generally in the tens of parts being, so it's not very high. A lot of it goes down the drain. A lot of it goes out the back door. Some people just lead, instead of a valve down there, they'll have a little hose that leads out through a hole in the wall. There'll also be a little elbow, usually copper piping, out the side of the wall opposite this machine, and you'll see it drip, or you may see some steam run out there. But it's that's how the vacuum pump discharges. Next slide, please. Slide number 38. Lint. Lint's found in a dry clean machine in the button trap, in the pump strainer, and the airflow system just before the heating and condensing coils and before the carbon absorber. And it will have solvent in it. A lot of people, I've seen piles of it out the back door along the building. On some of the petroleum operations that are running transfer machines for the dryer or tumbler, right under the vent, which is just a few inches off the ground, you'll see lint. And if you put an FID under that vent while that dryer's operating, it'll light it up. And if you sample soil where that vent outlet is, you'll find solvent in the soil. Slide number 39, please. Well, as Don said, solvent's valuable, and dry cleaners recycle it through clarification processes, filtration, and distillation. But you can have solvent as a waste product. And so how does this happen? The main reason is that they're not doing proper maintenance. In a petroleum solvent operation, if too much water gets introduced into the system, you'll get biodegradation, and you get a really foul smell, and there's only one thing to do, and that's change out the solvent. They do have biocides that they add to petroleum solvent to try to prevent that, but that has to be discarded. In a PERC operation, one of the big problems is failure to regulate the pH of the solvent, and it can become very high or very low, and it will corrode the machinery. And I'll show you an extreme example of that next. And in those examples, you have to get rid of the solvent. When you read about the old waterproofing operations, they had dip tanks, and a lot of times PERC was the carrier for the waterproofing agent, which was a wax. And after a while of dipping the clothing into the vats, you had to get rid of that solvent. So what did they do with that? Slide number 40, please. This is a bucket of separator water. It looks like antifreeze, on at least with this slide. But the green color is dissolved metals from a severe corrosion problem in a dry cleaning machine. And this operator, who wasn't very familiar with dry cleaning, would take his separator water and pour it back into the drum. So this solvent cycled through there many times and corroded the machinery. Next slide, please, slide number 41. Another source of solvent waste are spilled, leaked, and discharged solvents. And this exhibit comes from a paper that's on the SCRD website, and it's entitled Documented Leaks, Spills, and Discharges at Florida Dry Cleaning Sites. And the origin of this is that during the application process for the Florida Dry Cleaning Solvent Cleanup Program, all operators were required, that were active facilities, were required to fill out a questionnaire on operational practice and waste management practices. And one of the questions essentially was, have you ever had a leak, spill, or discharge of solvent, and what were the circumstances? So we had 348 facilities that fessed up and said that they did have an incident or incidents, and it was a total of 530 incidents, and those were mostly solvent discharges. And this is how we broke it out. Number one was equipment failures. This would be examples: failed gaskets, seals, leaking fittings and hoses, and corrosion of valves. That was followed by equipment operation. Examples of this would be the boil over on a still, failure to let your filters drain, filter blowouts, door of the machine not closed when they turned it on. After that was solvent transfer and storage. This would be overfilling machines, overfilling solvent storage tanks, leaking valves on solvent storage tanks, dropped drums, things like that. That was followed by equipment maintenance, solvent spilled during filter changes, still bottoms spilled during still cleanouts, repair of pumps, clean out of the button trap. And that was followed by waste discharges. And the reason that's only 10% is because this was more a question on solvents and not waste. And then the miscellaneous category, that would be moving a machine with the solvent still in it, machine vandalized, things like that. We don't claim that this is representative of what happens in the industry, and we don't claim that it's representative of what happens in Florida. This is just doing the statistics on this questionnaire, and this is what we found. So that's all I have, and I'm going to turn it over to Terry Evanson at this time. So turn to slide number 42, please.
Thank you very much, Bill. Now that you have an understanding of the dry cleaning processes, equipment, and waste streams, we're going to now turn to site reconnaissance to scope areas of likely chemical release and focus on where environmental samples should be collected. So that at the end of this section of the presentation, when you've finished your site reconnaissance, you want to be able to actually mark the spots where the site investigation team will be collecting samples. So we'll move on to slide 43. Of course, at any cleanup site, site reconnaissance is going to be critical to the development of your conceptual site model and to identifying how and where a release may have occurred and the possible environmental pathways where the contaminant may have migrated. One of the things I want to emphasize here is that in the document we're discussing today, which is conducting contaminant assessment work at dry cleaning sites, there is an appendix that provides a very thorough checklist for a dry cleaning site visit and will help you go through all of the specifics of the things that we're discussing here today as you actually enter and inspect a dry cleaner in determining where you're going to do an environmental assessment. And, of course, your site reconnaissance is going to typically start with file reviews and interviews and the like. We're going to move on to slide 44. You're going to want to address and to identify sensitive receptors that will help you focus where you'll be collecting your samples and look at the whole history of the facility operation. And I think this is one of the things that make dry cleaners particularly, dry cleaning sites, site investigations particularly challenging is because there are often multiple owners over a long period of time. It's not unusual in the state of Wisconsin to have dry cleaners owned for 40 or 50 years in one location or very near each other, and to have multiple owners having use multiple solvents, different dry cleaning machines, and of course different setups and uses within the dry cleaning building. And all of that's going to make it somewhat complicated for the site investigation. You're also going to want to look at nearby businesses to help determine what other chemicals may be co-located on the property. As I said, as was mentioned by Don earlier, a very large percentage, something in the order of between 70% and 80% of dry cleaners are located in strip malls. And, of course, the historical waste management practices are going to be one of the most important aspects of properly targeting your sample collection. We'll move on to slide 45. This is simply a list of the dry cleaning equipment that has already been discussed. Now, it's easier, clearly, to identify where this equipment is located if you're investigating an operating or a recently closed dry cleaning facility. It's much more difficult to identify where the equipment may have been located if the dry cleaner has been out of business for a long time or perhaps the building's not even in existence any longer. But you're going to want to focus on trying to identify where these pieces of equipment were as you go through your site reconnaissance. Please go to slide 46. One of the questions you're going to want to know is going to be, how was the solvent actually delivered to the premises? In the past, a solvent may have been delivered in everything from 5-gallon pails to large trucks that came to the facility and used hoses, brought hoses into the facility and filled up the dry cleaning machine, the way you'd fill up your tank of your gasoline tank at a gas station. And of course, leaks of solvent could occur along the hose, spills at the machines, and leaks at tanks wherever the perchloroethylene or whatever solvent was being used at that time was stored. You want to identify, of course, your utility lines. Obviously, you want to identify overhead utility lines and the like for the safety reasons as you're doing your investigation. As was pointed out, we have a lot of vacuum lines and the like above the heads of the investigators. But sewer and septic, sewer lines, septic tanks, are extremely important to locate and identify because this was where it was very common to dispose of separator water, and before regulations were in place, use solvent and the like itself. You're going to want to identify or any reports of past spills, violations of waste handling regulations and the like. And the last thing I list on this slide is the surface water drainage patterns, and it's important to identify these to help you recognize migration pathways away from the original release. On slide 47, we just want to point out that after you've done sort of this basic investigation using files and inquiries and interviews, you're going to want to put together a site conceptual model to help you actually identify where you're going to be looking for the indications of contaminant release. One of the things I want to point out that's unique to dry cleaners is that it's not uncommon to have perchloroethylene co-located with petroleum, a petroleum solvent that was used in dry cleaning, or sometimes with petroleum that was used to fill the tanks of the trucks that delivered the dry cleaning, or maybe even the co-location of a dry cleaner that had previously been a gas station. And it's not just a historical, that is, people used a Stoddard solvent machine, say in the 1950s, and by the 1970s they changed to using perchloroethylene. What we'll find is that sometimes, even today in Wisconsin, you may actually have dry cleaners that have side-by-side machines, a Stoddard's machine with a perchloroethylene machine. So these aren't just historical sequential releases, but they may have occurred side by side, and like I say, you actually may see these kinds of solvents being used side by side today even. We'll go on to slide 48 to actually start discussing where to sample at dry cleaning solvent source areas. And this picture is simply meant to point out that when you're actually doing investigations within a dry cleaning facility, you've got very tight quarters to do your sample collection. This can present its own difficulties. We'll go on to slide 49. So probably the first place you're going to want to look for possible environmental releases and contamination is at the dry cleaning machine itself. Bill's already pointed out the various ways solvents were released from the dry cleaning machine. It's going to be one of the most common sources of solvent contamination, and you're typically going to want, if the machine is there, you're going to want to take samples from in front of and behind the machine, overflow from the separator bucket, and these still bottoms from behind the machine are common sources for finding solvent back of the machine. And the other thing I want to point out is that perchloroethylene readily moves through concrete. I've talked with a few dry cleaners about this, and they typically don't believe me, but PCE that's been spilled on the floor or whatever will readily move through that concrete into the soil beneath. On slide 50, I simply point out here that besides sampling right at the dry cleaning machine, you're going to want to look to sample near expansion joints or floor cracks near the machine, and if possible, taking grab samples of groundwater if the groundwater is shallow enough. On slide 51, we move to the distillation units. Now, the distillation units are built into the newer machines. But in the past, they were standalone equipment, and they were not only inside the building. Occasionally, the distillation machine was actually, or the distillation unit was actually located outside the building. And so, you're going to want to see if this was the situation where this unit might have been located. You can see here this is looking brown. It's not unusual for the distillation units to have boiled over, and for those still bottoms to have been splattered on the ground or on the walls, and so that's how you're going to try to identify those kinds of areas for your environmental sampling. On slide 52, we'll move to discussing the storage area. near the service door, which is usually the back door. And next to the dry cleaning machine itself, the back door of the facility is going to be the most likely place to look for contamination. If you go on to slide 53, we try to discuss why it is that the back door is such a potent place for solvent spills and for contamination to reside. You know, the solvents were delivered through the back door and waste were taken out the back door and often stored outside the back door. In some facilities, there are multiple back doors, and so you want to identify the one located closest to the dry cleaning machine as the point where the solvent release most likely took place. You're going to want to look at the pavement, and perchloroethylene will, in fact, of course, dissolve pavement, and that if you see deteriorated pavement, that can be a clue to you that there's been waste release in that area. And when you sample outside the back door, if you can identify the direction in which the back door opened, the highest contamination is usually opposite the location of where the door opened. All right, if we go on to slide 54, we're going to talk about the sewer lines and drains, and these have already been alluded to in the earlier. So it's a good practice to walk around the outside of the dry cleaning building and identify anything that exits the building and then trace the pipe, the hose, or the drain back into the building to understand its source. And it's not unusual, particularly from the waste from the press tables, to have been discharged outside the building. And while the concentrations were fairly low, because it's not unusual for these facilities to have operated for decades, that small accumulation of contamination can build up and become significant over time. If you go to slide 55, we want to talk about the sanitary sewer and drain field. Historically, the separator water was disposed into sewer lines. As has been pointed out, even if you've got a treatment unit that is based on filtration, filtering the separator water to remove the perch, if those filters are not maintained, then the separator water, you know, they become useless for you, and the separator water that was acceptable or may have been acceptable for disposing into the sanitary sewer may actually be at much higher concentrations than the dry cleaner operator understands. Besides that, taking the standard kind of soil groundwater, soil vapor samples, you might also want to collect samples of wastewater and sludge samples from sewer laterals and septic tanks that service the facility, and sample near any floor drains that you find at the facility. Another thing to be cognizant of is that perchloroethylene can dissolve PVC piping. And so if you've got PVC piping beneath the floor or that connects the dry cleaner to the sanitary sewer, the piping itself is susceptible to dissolution and, of course, leakage then of any of the waste. We'll go on to slide 56 and talk about above ground and below ground or underground storage tanks for perchloroethylene. Typically, if perchloroethylene was stored in tanks, it was stored in above ground tanks at most dry cleaning stores. However, occasionally you will indeed find an underground storage tank. And the picture here on the left of slide 56 shows an underground storage tank. The perchloroethylene was removed from that tank in the mid-80s, but the tank is still in the ground and has now filled with groundwater that is only a few inches beneath the actual foundation of this dry cleaner. And I want to point out here, I take a moment to make a segue here, the concrete slab that you see the gentleman has his foot on on that slab in the 1960s and probably early 1970s, there was a series of coin-operated dry cleaning machines, and the perchloroethylene in the tank fed those coin-operated dry cleaning machines with perchloroethylene. Coin-operated dry cleaning machines resemble coin-operated dryers that you would see in a laundry facility today. So they were very small, and to be as small as they were, they simply filtered the used perch. They didn't have any kind of distillation system, and of course they didn't have any kind of condenser or whatever would be appropriate for collecting the PCE vapors. So the solvent, because it was only filtered, it became unusable much more quickly than in a regular dry cleaning machine. So the solvent had to be changed much more frequently and disposed of. And that's one of the reasons in which we'll see these much higher concentrations. It's our experience at any rate that at these coin-operated dry cleaning facilities, the concentrations of perchloroethylene are really quite high. You've got the leakage from the underground tank, the disposal of the perchloroethylene, and of course, people overfill the machines with clothes, and the perch wasn't always effectively removed during the cleaning process. And then, of course, the disposable filters that were on these machines were also, just thrown out in the trash. In 1977, it is estimated that there were 18,000 coin-operated dry cleaning machines in the United States. So if we go on to slide 57, this is just to tell you that modern dry cleaning machines, there is no need to store perchloroethylene outside the machine. The perchloroethylene is only stored within the machine. But you should look for historical places where there may have been above-ground or underground tanks, as well as the fact that there may have been fuel tanks on the property for running the boilers and gasoline for trucks. On slide 58, we just want to talk about poor storage and waste handling and identifying where waste were stored on the grounds of the dry cleaner. And typically, again, this is somewhere outside the back of the dry cleaning facility. And I guess I want to point out that these are not only historical practices that we're talking about. On slide 58 in the upper right-hand corner, you see a stack of filter cartridges standing outside the back door of the dry cleaner. That picture was taken last month. We'll go on to slide 59. You're going to want to identify where the dumpsters and trash cans were located. Historically, the filters, the muck, the steel bottoms, the lint were disposed of in waste containers to be, just carried away. And, of course, a leakage occurred from those sites and spillage and the like. And you're going to clearly want to be able to take samples in those locations. We'll go on to slide 60. And this just is the same picture you saw from Bill's presentation on the misters for the separator discharge. Mist coming out of these misters may very well be saturated with perchloroethylene, and you're going to, if you find these, find a mister at a property, you're going to want to sample the soils located beneath that device. It's very important to identify, if possible, how the separator water is or was handled at the facility. We'll go on to slide 61. And vacuum and press water, and as I mentioned earlier, while these are historically fairly low level, contain fairly low levels of perchloroethylene compared to some of these other waste streams, the fact that they were discharged often to the ground or to the sewer line for decades can mean that there is significant contamination at the location where that discharge took place. On slide 62, we'll talk about I just want to mention the question of vapor intrusion and the fact that this is probably one of the driving issues for cleanup at dry cleaners, certainly in Wisconsin today. Most of the solvents, of course, that were used were volatile organic chemicals, and you're going to using soil vapor samples both beneath the dry cleaner and at adjacent in adjacent soils or adjacent buildings are going to be important in identifying the extent of the contamination. The other issue that was brought up earlier, which is that chemicals, besides perchloroethylene, of course, may very well be contributing to vapors such as carbon, everything from carbon tetrachloride, 111 TCA, and other chemicals. Okay, then we'll go on to slide 63. And the question is, what if the equipment is gone? So we've talked about trying to identify where this equipment is, recognizing that you want to, you know, collect environmental samples to identify if releases have occurred in those places. But we're often faced with a situation where the operating dry cleaner is closed, and then you have to sort of start using some guesswork to identify where this equipment may have been. Slide 63, the picture there simply shows, this is a picture where a dry cleaning machine has been removed, and you're able to identify its location by the fact that there are still machine bolts that have been, you know, cut off at the floor, and you've got a different discoloration of the floor compared to the floor around it. And so that may help you identify where some of the machinery is. And, of course, things like the spills, the discoloration from the spill bottoms and the like will help you identify, you know, where you might sample. But you still have the question of, you know, what happens if the dry cleaners become the, you know, coffee shop or the hair salon. If we go on to slide 64, one of our recommendations is that you go back to that basic layout of how the dry cleaning operation is set up. And if you can identify where the front door is and where the back door is, then typically the dry cleaning machine is in the back third of the store. If you can identify piping or drains or the like in the building, those typically don't change that much, that'll help give you a clue as to where to begin taking your samples. On slide 65, we have the situation where, of course, the building may not even exist any longer. We have redevelopment situations and the building's completely gone and we don't have any clues as to where, at least physical clues on the ground as to where the contamination may be. In this case, you may have to rely upon aerial photography, focusing on the time when the dry cleaner operated, or sandborne maps, which sometimes will actually show the location of the dry cleaning machine and the building at the time of the map. Otherwise, some of the assessment approaches that Steve will be speaking about in a moment can help you identify the contaminant source areas. And so with that, I will turn the time over to Steve.
Thank you, Terry. Good afternoon. Let's move on to slide 67. Once the areas requiring investigation have been established, the site investigator has a variety of assessment techniques available for evaluating dry cleaner sites. In each investigation, the goal is to identify areas of contamination and delineate their extent. This presentation will focus on the technologies listed on the slide. They have been selected because of their value in the early stages of investigating a dry cleaner site. The implementation of many of these technologies results in real-time information concerning subsurface conditions. The efficiency of an investigation is enhanced when investigators can make rapid decisions concerning the direction of the investigation, and significant cost savings may result. Slide 68, please. The first topic in this section is soil gas surveys. These are particularly useful when an on-site building has been demolished and there is no information available concerning the site. If time is not an issue, passive soil gas methods are reliable in locating septic tanks, sewer lines, and other dry cleaning relics. Well-planned soil gas surveys can also reveal indications of groundwater flow direction after contaminant gradients are mapped. The costs of conducting soil gas surveys are usually lower than conventional sampling techniques because a large gridded area of soil gas points can be installed in a short time compared to sample collection. Slide 69. The New Jersey DEP conducted a subsurface investigation at a phantom or former dry cleaner located in Waldwick, New Jersey. The fact that a dry cleaner had formerly operated where a bank is located was confirmed by other dry cleaner operators in the town who were eager to share their insights. The owner of the strip mall was not as willing to provide information, but finally offered that he had removed the septic system located at the rear of the building during site renovations. This site shows a 1960 sewer modification permit obtained during a file review at the municipal building. The permit detailed the addition of two 1,000-gallon seepage tanks connected to the former dry cleaner building. As Terry mentioned in her presentation, this slide demonstrates the importance of a thorough file review. Please turn to slide 70. This slide shows the final product resulting from a passive soil gas survey at the Phantom Dry Cleaner. The soil gas points were placed based upon information obtained from the sewer permit and a grid system. The grid system ensured that there were no other septic relics and provided insights on the distribution of the contaminant. The soil gas survey map highlighted three areas of elevated PCE concentration. Two of the areas corresponded with the septic tanks identified on the sewer permit, and the third area showed residual contamination from the septic system that was removed near the building. A monitoring well installed adjacent to the elevated soil gas readings near the septic tanks confirmed the presence of PCE at a concentration of 140 parts per billion at 26 feet below ground surface. This map was also used to direct the excavations at the rear of the former dry cleaner, and the presence of the two septic tanks, including the one shown in slide 68, was confirmed. Slide 71. Several companies have developed methodology for passive soil gas surveys, but the New Jersey DEP has the most familiarity with the Gore-Thorver system. The primary component of the Gore system is the Gore-Thorver module, shown in the lower right-hand corner of the slide. The module is installed in a 1-inch diameter, 2 to 4 foot boring, and left for 2 weeks. The Gore-Tex membrane allows contaminants to enter the module where they are absorbed on charcoal. The module also can be suspended within saturated zones because the Gore-Tex membrane prevents water infiltration but allows contaminant transfer. After collection, the modules are analyzed by Gore, who provides the results in tabular form and then in mapped form, as shown in the previous slide. Remember that using passive soil gas surveys as the main component of a site characterization approach is usually not sufficient to reach the remediation stage. The surveys are useful, however, in providing a first look into the subsurface, greatly enhancing the ability of an investigator to locate source areas, site monitoring wells and plan future directions of the investigation. Two disadvantages of the passive soil gas survey is that it takes separate mobilizations to install and collect the modules, and the waiting time between installation, collection, and receiving the results. A detailed PowerPoint presentation on Gorzorver modules was prepared by the Kansas Dry Cleaning Program. The web address for the presentation is located on the lower left-hand portion of this slide. Slide 72. An alternative to passive soil gas surveys is the active gas soil survey. Active soil gas sampling enables rapid decisions concerning investigation strategies to be made on-site almost in real time. In active soil gas sampling, soil gas is withdrawn from the subsurface through a screen point or through a vapor extraction well using an electric or manual portable vacuum pump into a gas-tight blast syringe or a Tedler bag for immediate analysis. The left-hand photo shows a simple manual vacuum syringe, and the right-hand photo shows a Tedlar bag from which a syringe is extracting soil gas for analysis. Soil gas concentrations are obtained on-site from portable gas chromatographs, or GCs, mobile laboratories, or even colorimetric tubes. An additional advantage of active soil gas sampling is that soil gas data can be collected from discrete depths and the vertical extent of contamination can be profiled. Given suitable subsurface conditions, 10 to 30 active soil gas samples can be collected and analyzed per day. The limiting factors of active soil gas surveys are based on the subsurface lithology at each site. Low permeability soils and shallow groundwater tables reduce the effectiveness of active soil gas sampling. Slide 73. An extreme version of active soil gas surveys is modified active gas sampling, or MAGS. MAGS utilizes a network of vapor extraction wells fitted with vacuum gauges. By applying a high-pressure vacuum, MAGS is capable of assessing up to a 20-foot radius in sandy soils at a single extraction point. By sequentially testing MAGS data points and determine the areas where vacuum areas of influence intersect, contaminant areas may be readily identified. The photo shows an investigator screening the discharge of a vacuum device with an organic vapor analyzer. After mastering the MAGS technique, the subsurface of a typical dry cleaner can be assessed in a day or two. The web address posted at the bottom right-hand portion of this slide will get you to an excellent PowerPoint summary of MAGS technology, which is available through the SCRD website. Slide 74. We now move on to direct push technology, which is the most important technology used in the assessment of dry cleaners. It is from a direct push platform that multimedia sample collection is enabled and other probing technologies made possible. The New Jersey DEP uses a GeoProbe machine, and I will likely use GeoProbe interchangeably with direct push technology. The need for assessing a variety of subsurface conditions has created the need for a wide variety of direct push technology machines. The GeoProbe machine in the upper right-hand corner of the slide is a beast that can advance steel drill rods through almost anything but solid rock. We have discovered that when working in glacial sediments, it is worth the extra money to engage a larger machine. The machine shown in the lower left-hand photo is a portable geoprobe that can be set up inside of buildings. It is particularly useful for collecting soil samples beneath dry cleaner machines and other interior spaces. The lower right-hand corner photo shows the DEP geoprobe setup. Slide 75, please. Direct push technology simplifies the collection of soil samples, especially compared with using split spoons and a cat head on a drill rig. Direct push technology is particularly useful for collecting continuous soil borings. Acetate liners, in which the soil is collected, come in a variety of sizes. The photos show open macrocore acetate liners and the soil core being described by a geologist. One important reason to collect soil samples during a dry cleaner investigation is to document a surface fill, such as the soil beneath an atomizer or the release of contamination under the slab. It is important that soil samples be collected within the vadose zone, which is the interval between the ground surface and the water table, because a soil sample collected within the zone that the water table fluctuates may cause an investigator to make the misplaced assumption that the soil contamination resulted from a surface release. But remember, while soil sample collection within the saturated zone is meaningless, it is important to describe the soils in the saturation zone to document sediment types and to determine the presence of confining layers, permeable intervals, and other parameters. Slide 76. New Jersey uses direct push technologies extensively for groundwater sampling, mainly for the vertical profiling of contamination. GeoProbe has a number of ways in which to sample groundwater, but a New Jersey DEP GeoProbe operator developed a unique system to collect groundwater samples. The upper left photo shows a point screen combination used to collect groundwater samples. The system consists of a sacrificial point connected to a 4-foot screen that fits within the GeoProbe rod. After the rod is advanced to the desired depth, the drill rod string is pulled up 3 to 4 feet. Because the screen is attached to the point, it stays in place, exposing itself to the saturated zone, eliminating the need for push rods that are usually needed to push the screen into the void left when the rods are pulled up. The lower left photo shows a DEP geologist collecting a groundwater sample using a check valve attached to polyethylene tubing. The first sample collected is analyzed by the portable gas chromatograph operator shown in the lower right-hand photo. The advantage of using a portable GC on site is that decisions can rapidly be made concerning the depth on which to focus and the extent of contamination can be delineated. Please turn to slide 77. This cross-section is based on a vertical profiling investigation conducted along a 1/2-mile street to a depth of 80 feet below ground surface using a field GC. Groundwater was detected at 18 feet below ground surface, and the areas where there is no data are areas where PCE was not detected. When conducting a subsurface investigation at a dry cleaner site, the intervals between sampling points are much closer. On a dry cleaner site, vertical profiling is valuable for locating contaminant source areas and delineating contaminant plumes. Slide 78. Direct push technology also simplifies the collection of soil gas samples. Besides being able to penetrate resistant strata and going deeper than boring by hand, direct push systems such as GeoProbe have adopted tooling methodology and enables the collection of soil gas samples. Illustrated in the left-hand side of the slide is the GeoProbe post-run tubing system, or PRT, which is a system used to locate and delineate contaminant areas. The primary benefit of the system is its ability to collect soil vapor samples quickly and easily at discrete sampling depths without the need to withdraw the entire drive rod string after each sample. A soil gas sample is drawn through the point holder, through the PRT adapter, into the sample tubing, and finally into a sample collection device. Slide 79. Direct push technology is also used to install microwells. Microwells provide an inexpensive yet effective method for obtaining groundwater samples. Microwells can be installed for collection of groundwater samples on a temporary basis, or when placed in secured, out-of-the-way locations, they can be effective as long-term monitoring points. The primary benefit of installing microwells is that since they are installed with direct push technology, investigation-derived wastes such as drill cuttings and purge water are minimized. Groundwater flow direction may be determined by a series of microwells, and a single microwell may be used for pneumatic slug testing to determine aquifer characteristics. The downside of microwell utilization is that each state has their own standards and level of acceptance of their use. This completes the section on direct push technology, and slide 80 begins the section on the soil conductivity probe. The soil conductivity probe is a device attached to the end of a drill string that measures the electrical conductivity of soil. The cable of the probe is fed up through the drill rods to a field instrument that provides a control interface for the probe and receives and compiles data. The probe is advanced through the soil using direct push technology and provides a continuous reading of the electrical conductivity of the soil sediment. Lithologic information gathered with the soil conductivity probe is used to assist the investigator in understanding the movement and location of contaminants in the subsurface. This information can also assist in the proper placement of monitoring or extraction wells. Because site conditions vary considerably, it is important to verify lithologic changes identified by the conductivity probe by comparing a soil conductivity log to an actual soil boring. Slide 81. The conductivity soils is different for each type of media. Finer grain sediments, such as silt or clays, have a higher electrical conductivity signal, while coarser grain sediments, such as sands and gravel, have a lower electrical conductivity signal. Coarser grain sediments allow greater migration of contaminants, and the finer grain sediments tend to limit their migration. A day or two of conductivity profiling enables the development of a stratigraphic framework across a site. Slide 82. This slide begins a discussion of the membrane interface probe, or MIP. The MIP, like the soil conductivity probe, is attached to the first drive rods of a geoprobe string. However, in addition to a soil conductivity probe, the MIP features a percussion-tolerant sensor that continuously logs volatile organics that diffuse through a semipermeable membrane located on the probe. The upper right-hand illustration shows how volatile contamination located near the sensor is volatilized by heat from the probe and drawn through the membrane on the probe. The volatile contamination is then transported by a carrier gas to the surface through tubing connected to either an electron capture device, a photoionization detector, or a flame ionization detector for immediate analysis. Because of its array of detectors, the MIP is capable of detecting most volatile organic compounds, as well as petroleum hydrocarbons. Unfortunately, due to high detection limits on the analytical equipment, the MIP is limited to contaminant source delineation. But fortunately, contaminant source delineation is usually the most important element in dry cleaner assessments. The MIP also provides soil electrical conductivity data so that real-time data showing changes in sediment lithology can be compared to contaminant data. Slide 83. This log resulted from a dry cleaning facility in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. During its history, the dry cleaner used both petroleum cleaning solvents and PCE. The FID response at 10 feet below ground surface, located within the purple zone on the slide, is a zone contaminated with petroleum solvent, which was detected with the flame ionization detector. This is interesting because petroleum-based solvents are lighter than chlorinated solvents and would be expected to appear in the shallower depths of the soil column. The primary contamination at the site occurs between 21 and 42 feet below ground surface. The contaminant signature shows itself in the red zone of the slide on both the electron capture device and the photoionization detector. Eventual soil sampling at the site revealed that the bulk of the contaminant mass was located within a silty, fine-grained sand overlying a silty clay in the 33 to 36 feet below ground surface zone, highlighted in the green area. Slide 84. I've included this slide for reference. It details the types of detectors and their detection limits on a MIP probe, as well as the compounds they are capable of detecting. Slide 85. The main advantage in using MIP technology is the flexibility that results in subsurface investigations. The MIP's ability to delineate source areas and to a limited extent contaminant plumes can result in savings of time and money. Because chemical and physical logs generated by the MIP are simultaneously graphed in real time, there is instant feedback concerning lithologic change and the presence of contaminants. The MIP, with an electron capture device, can log up to 300 feet per day in both vadose and saturated zones. An additional benefit of MIP technology is that soil cuttings are not generated during the logging process. Finally, with the proper software, MIP technology can generate two-dimensional or three-dimensional cross-section maps of the site as data is acquired. This is especially valuable for source delineation and monitoring well placement. As for remediation, these maps will help to identify the optimal intervals for the injection of remediation materials. The main disadvantage to the MIP technology is the high detection limits on its detectors. MIP is most suited for delineation of contaminant source areas, but they can, in ideal situations, delineate plumes out to 250 parts per billion, depending on which detector is used. Co-workers with whom I have discussed MIP's technology are skeptical at detection limit claims of less than one part per million, but since most dry cleaners have significant releases of contamination, a detection limit of 1 ppm is usually sufficient. Now you may ask, is MIP technology affordable compared to traditional sampling methods? The cost may be justifiable. If you can quickly determine the location of a contaminant source area and the direction of its plume migration with MIP technology, you should be able to reduce the number of samples that would normally be collected with traditional sampling methods. If you factor in savings of not only field time, but analytical costs and project management costs, the cost of MIPs is usually justifiable. Slide 86 begins a brief discussion on mobile laboratories. When combined with direct push sampling, on-site mobile laboratories provide accurate, real-time sampling results. In the early stages of an investigation, mobile labs are useful to document contaminant source locations and delineate their vertical and horizontal extent. Turn to slide 87. The advantages of using a mobile lab typically outweigh the disadvantages. A mobile lab stationed on site will enhance productivity, and a subsurface investigation could realize significant cost savings. Most mobile labs provide on-site high-quality soil, groundwater, and air sample data generated during a direct push investigation. The data generated can immediately be compiled by a project manager, and rapid decisions concerning the direction of the investigation can be made. Cost savings include the limiting of downtime on work crews, cutting down on the number of site mobilizations and decrease sample management time. Site work plans can be adjusted in the field based on real-time data and informed decisions regarding the placements of borings or monitoring wells made. The use of a mobile lab is expensive, but its high cost can usually be justified when time savings from on-site efficiencies and the high cost of analysis and management of standard samples is considered. Slide 88 introduces the assessment of sanitary sewer lines. The compilation and interpretation of dry cleaner assessment data demonstrates that sanitary sewer lines are an important potential source of contamination. The investigation of sanitary sewer lines should be an integral part of all dry cleaner site assessments. It is surprising how often sanitary sewer lines are overlooked as potential sources of contamination. I've operated on the premise that once you find a dry well or septic tank, you're done. But that is not always the case. Turn to slide 89. The first task in assessing sanitary sewer lines is to collect available information. A file review in municipal or county engineering departments or sewer authorities could yield engineering plans for sewer improvements or permitting information relative to septics. Site visits are also important, and during the visit, one should try to note the locations of sanitary sewer laterals and mains, observe floor drains and manholes for directional clues for sewer lines, and speak to the owner or the plumber of the facility for additional insights. The two photos were taken during the excavation of a dry cleaner septic system. The location of the septic main and relics were determined from the soil gas study detailed in the early part of this presentation and were confirmed during their excavation. The upper slide shows a cross-section of the septic piping run and a monitoring well that had been installed adjacent to the piping run. The lower slide shows a septic tank prior to its removal. Records indicated that the septic system operated from the early 1960s and closed in 1971 when the dry cleaner was connected to a public water and sewer. Slide 90. It must be remembered that significant point source contamination may result from sewer line leaks that result from cracked, broken, or displaced mains or laterals. It is easiest to determine if a sewer line is leaking by performing a line tightness test. These tests are inexpensive and should be performed at the early stage of an investigation. If the sewer line is definitely leaking, it becomes important to locate the leak. Lacking maps or other documentation, the location of sewer lines may be determined by inserting a radio transmitter into the line. The transmitter within the pipe can be traced along the ground surface by using a handheld receiver over the pipe. After documenting the location of the sewer pipe on the ground surface, a soil gas study conducted along the pipe will locate the source of the contaminant release. Slide 91. There are three ways of assessing sewer lines by inner pipe methods, and they are hydrostatic testing, video inspections, and smoke testing. Slide 92 introduces hydrostatic testing. The easiest way to determine the likelihood of a release of contaminants from a sewer pipe is to perform a hydrostatic tightness test on the sewer pipe. Sewer line tightness tests cost as little as $500 and should be performed in the early stages of a subsurface investigation. Barring complications, the hydrostatic test can be simple to perform. The test begins by plugging the line near its outfall and is basically completed when water is added to the pipe from its origin within the building. If observations indicate that the water level in the pipe goes down, then isolation tests are then needed to locate the leak. Isolation tests use an inflatable test plug that is maneuvered throughout the sewer lines, and progressively smaller sections of the pipe are isolated and tested until the leak is found. Once a leak is located, it is documented and the rest of the system checked for additional leaks. A good leak detection company will test all sewer line branches and fixtures in order to locate all the leaks. And once all the testing is completed, provide a sketch of the building indicating the layout of the drain lines, including the location of the leaks. If the location of a leak is known, direct push technology may be used to collect soil and or groundwater samples near the leak. Even a small leak, occurring over many years, could result in significant contamination. Slide 93. There are situations where hydrostatic pressure testing is not possible. An alternative is performing a video inspection of the sewer line. Televising sewer lines has been a valuable way of assessing the condition of a sewer line in real time. Video inspections can reveal blockages and show cracks, breaks, or deterioration of a pipe. It allows for detailed diagnosis without the need for excavation and can save time and money. Video cameras with diameters as small as 1 inch can be inserted into sewer lines, and mains and laterals can be inspected. Color video shows greater detail than black and white video. Video will show large cracks or separations in the pipe, but even high-resolution video may miss small cracks. It is important to remember that video inspection is not a test and it cannot confirm leaks. After a suspected leak is discovered, it may be confirmed by a hydraulic test, a soil gas survey, or conducting sampling in the area of the suspected leak with direct push technology. Slide 94. The third inner pipe method of testing lines is smoke testing. Smoke testing consists of blowing smoke which mixed with large volumes of air into a line to be tested. Smoke is usually induced with pressure through a manhole and travels down the pipe. Ideally, if it encounters an area of the pipe that has experienced surface water inflow, the smoke will follow the path of least resistance and quickly show up at the corresponding area on the surface. Smoke can identify broken manholes, untapped lines, and even cracked mains and laterals, providing there is a passageway for the smoke to travel to the surface. The best results of smoke testing are obtained during dry weather, which allows smoke better opportunity to travel to the surface. The concern I see associated with this method of assessing sewer lines is that a subsurface condition or even the presence of pavement will prevent the smoke from appearing on the surface. I would like to conclude my presentation with a safety reminder, slide 95. Please, don't forget your utility mark apps. And the next slide. When it comes to underground utilities, you can never have too much information, as one of our geoprobe operators is demonstrating. Thank you for your interest. Now back to Jean.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. So again, we are on slide number 95, and we have just over 30 minutes left to handle Q&A with our instructors. We're going to alternate taking questions from individuals on the phone as well as those of you who are streaming the audio online. So before we begin with phone line questions, I'm going to remind those of you that are streaming the audio, and we do have well over 300 of you doing that, that you can go ahead and type up questions electronically. And I'd like you to start doing that if you haven't done it already. I do have a few in the queue already. In order to submit your questions or comments electronically, you'll need to click the question mark button that appears at the top of the slides in your web browser window. If you're having any problems, a new window should be popping up if you click that button, which will allow you to type up your question or comment, and then I'll read it out loud on your behalf. You want to be sure pop-up blockers are not enabled because that could prohibit or block the question window from appearing. So as long as your pop-up blockers are turned off, you should be able to click the question mark button to submit an electronic question. And again, I'll read those out loud on your behalf in just a few moments. So while we do have a couple of those that have already been submitted, and those are in the queue, and again, I will read them when we turn to the online questions. While we wait for some additional questions to be typed up electronically, let's start with our phone line participants, and we do have about 200 of you on the phone lines right now. So So I'm going to provide a reminder that if you are on the phones and you would like to ask the instructors a question, you may do so by taking yourself off of mute. We're going to go time zone by time zone across the U.S., and we're going to start in the East Coast time zone. So anyone who's in the East Coast time zone, if you're on the phone lines, if you have a question for the instructor, you may take yourself off of mute by hitting #6 on your telephone. We'd ask that you identify yourself or organization and then ask your question directly to our speakers. Okay, if I don't hear anything in the East Coast, I'm going to move along to the very next time zone, which is the Central time zone. Again, if anyone's in the Central time zone and has a question for our presenters, please hit #6 on your telephone, identify yourself or an organization, and ask your question out loud. Okay, I'll move right along to our Mountain time zone participants. Again, if you're in the Mountain time zone, hit #6. Please identify yourself or organization and ask a question out loud.
Hi, my name is Craig Eaton. I'm with IHI Environmental. I do have a quick question.
Go right ahead.
I'm wondering if what the experience is of the presenters about concerns with conducting investigations inside of dry cleaning facilities. And, you know, obviously you have to core through the concrete floor of the facilities, and if you're introducing new conduits for potential future problems.
I guess I can answer that. This is Bill Lynn, Florida DEP. We always sample inside, so we core through the concrete. We get our samples. We actually increasingly install water table monitoring wells in active dry cleaning facilities. When we first started, we we didn't do that. We were concerned about creating pathways, but what we've learned is it's a good emergency indicator if there's been a new release at a facility. But we take our samples normally, and then we'll plug the concrete. But inside's the best place to sample in terms of looking for source errors in our experience. Does that answer your question?
It does. But are you guys concerned about future problems because of the new conduits you've created inside of the facilities? Or I understand that it is a good way to do testing, but.
Well, as long as you plug them with concrete, we don't see a problem with it, no.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. Again, if you're on the phone lines and you've asked a question, you want to be sure to remute your line by hitting *6. Again, we're going to go back to the Mountain time zone. If anyone else in Mountain time zone has a question, you can unmute by hitting #6 and then identify yourself and organization to type up your question or to ask your question out loud to our instructors.
Hi, this is Brian Martinick with Trihydro Corporation. I have a question regarding slide number 33.
Sure. Go ahead.
With that, I believe that was showing a filter processing machine or a machine that was cleaning the filters. And I was curious, is that a machine that was present on site at a dry cleaner, a commercial dry cleaner, or was that a processing facility that's off site from a dry cleaner that was processing and cleaning? Refurbishing canister filters.
Is this, you said slide 33?
I believe it was slide 33, yes.
Slide 33, of course, the top two are cartridge filters. On the bottom is a spin disk filtration unit, which is a...
Yeah, it's actually slide 34, I'm sorry.
And hang on. Ah, those are filler housings for standard cartridges. So You pull the cover off. There's a series of cartridge filters in there, and stacked end to end, 6 to 8 of them. In between are the gaskets, and on the ends are the gaskets. So this is an active filter system at dry cleaner, and you'll see these.
Okay.
You'll see a lot of these at petroleum solvent dry cleaners because they chiefly use filtration to clarify solvent, and very few of those use distillation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, so these are that's actually a filtration unit acts at, like in the back of an actual dry cleaning machine at a dry cleaner. It's not an off-site processing facility.
That's correct.
Okay. This is
Don. Yeah.
I would add that everything we've talked about here.
I had one other question, if I may, and that's regarding the MIPS discussion that we just heard, and regarding the detection limits being rather high and about 1 ppm. Is that referring to 1 ppm as in, for example, groundwater, or is that 1 ppm in soil vapor? Can you clarify that?
Just a minute. Don, did you have a reply on that first question?
Well, I just wanted to mention that everything we're talking about here today is at dry cleaning facilities themselves, and I don't think we are talking about any kind of any other kind of facilities that might, for instance, in this example, treat solvent off site somewhere. Everything's at the dry cleaner.
Okay. On the MIP question, we run those extensively at Florida. We don't go into a new site with a MIP. We use the MIP on the highly contaminated sites, and we use the MIP in the source area for a day or two or maybe three of work right in the source area to determine the stratigraphy and the distribution of the high concentrations. So we I think they probably detect lower than 1 ppm, but you do get MIP response in the unsaturated zone and the saturated zone, but that's a semi-quantitative response. It doesn't translate to micrograms per liter or milligrams per kilogram. Does that answer your question?
Okay, yeah, that's helpful. It kind of precipitated a related question. You said you use MIPS not on the new sites, but on the highly contaminated sites. By new sites, you mean a dry cleaning facility that hasn't operated very long?
I would mean a site that's eligible for the program, and we go out there cold to begin the assessment, and you never know if you're going to have one that's extremely contaminated or one that's not very contaminated. And if you use a MIP on one with low contaminant concentrations, you may not see much or anything. So our rule of thumb is that if we find PERC 10% of the aqueous solubility or greater, we'll normally follow up with a MIP and use the MIP data for our remedial design, and also to make sure that we screen the monitor wells. If our monitor wells aren't screened in the right places based on the MIP data, we'll put in some more monitor wells, screen them over those intervals. Does that answer your question?
Yes. When you say detect at 10% aqueous solubility, you mean by what means are you
okay,
screening? That you mean in a well or in a soil sample?
Groundwater sample. So PERC has a water solubility of about 150 milligrams per liter. So if we see 15,000 micrograms per liter PERC or greater, that would be a candidate to run the MIP on for us. And that's about, on what we see, that's about 1 in 7 sites are highly contaminated, and those are the problem ones.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, great. Again, we're going to move to the Pacific time zone and see if anybody out on the West Coast has a question. If you're in the Pacific time zone, please unmute your line by hitting #6, identify yourself, and ask your question. Those of you who may have unmuted, you can remute by hitting *6. So, again, if you have a question in the Pacific time zone, hit #6, identify yourself or your organization, and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Rich Fink with Kleinfelder, and I had a question on slide number 77, which showed the soil profile using GeoProbe below groundwater and having a contamination profile with depth. And I had a concern over dragging down contamination from above down to your lower sample, and did you do any kind of correlation with monitoring wells at specific depths or anything to kind of verify some of these vertical profiles?
No, we haven't installed monitoring wells. We were looking for a contaminant plume where it may be coming through the half-mile-long area. We don't have concern with contaminating deeper zones with vertical profiling.
Well, I wasn't worried as much about cross-contamination or deeper drag than just carrying something down in the parpabillion range where you might be seeing numbers that may be higher once you penetrate that dirtier stuff up above and taking it down and having some erroneously high values and anticipating that the plume goes deeper than it really is.
Well, there's a lot of clays in the soils that we assess, and driving the geoprobe creates smear zones, which tend to limit the migration of groundwater throughout the column.
Again, I wasn't talking about migration as much as just dragging it down with the equipment and then just having the dirty part at the end where you're taking dissolved samples that will pull in some additional data that will make you be erroneously deep. That's all.
At the end of the sample is just an exposed area. A 3-foot area that, do you understand how the process works?
Yes, I've used it quite a bit, and especially with the expendable tip, as you could push down through clays and whatnot and drag some down, depends on the coarseness and how hard you have to push the instrument down for the probe down, and
we've seen
just a concern I had whether or not it had been correlated with depth with any other source other than just taking this just the value that you got.
We've seen some drag down on our sites, and the proof of it is that when we subsequently put in deeper wells, we didn't have anything, but it occurs.
Right, that's what I'm wondering about.
We've seen it, and it occurs. I agree with your observation on that. It can happen.
Okay.
I would add, if in a situation like this, when you're looking, especially off-site, distal parts of plumes, that this is a screening stage here, and I think it's definitely worth doing, especially if you're in soils that are coarser. And you're going to be getting good transmissivity of the water into the sampling device. It's definitely worthwhile doing, I believe.
Okay.
If you were working in a source area, obviously, I think you'd be much more concerned about that.
Okay, great. Let's see if we have any other questions in the Pacific time zone. Again, it's #6 to unmute your line, identify yourself or organization, and ask your question. Okay, let's quickly then, if we can, in any other time zone. So this will be mostly applicable for our international participants. If you're on the phone lines and you're not in the Eastern, Central, Mountain, or Pacific time zones, please feel free to take yourself off of mute now by hitting #6 to identify yourself, organization, and ask your question directly to our speakers.
Yes, my name is Mark Grossman. I'm with the Insurance Services Office, and I wanted to know, there was a lot of focus on PERC and Stoddard solvent. What about solvents like N-propyl bromide? Any comments on that or how that fits into the mix? Is it a more corrosive dry cleaning solvent? Does it present any kind of detection problems in the field compared to the other more common solvents? So any comments on N-propyl bromide would be appreciated.
We haven't evaluated any sites where N-propyl bromide has been used. It's not real clear.
As a dry cleaning solvent, both at the dry cleaning shop, whether it's more prone to leakage or there are any particular problems, it runs through filters faster, as well as analyzing it and evaluating it in the field.
I'm not even certain that it has been used in Florida, and if it has, it's only been in the last maybe 3 years. It's about the time that was introduced as a dry clean solvent.
Okay.
So I don't really have any experience with it.
No, in Jersey we haven't detected it as a groundwater contaminant as yet.
Okay, so right now would it be fair to say it's pretty much off the scope, or do you foresee coming down the line a whole set of problems with N-propyl bromide?
There may be some problems with it, yeah. On the waste management practices, a lot of the old waste management practices are still being done by some of the dry cleaners. One, because they're not trained. Two, because hazardous waste disposal is a high cost of doing business, and some of them just don't do it. So any of the new solvents could be a problem in the future.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
You bet.
Okay, great. So at this point, I'm going to ask everyone to put themselves back on mute. If you've unmuted, you'll need to hit *6 to remute your line. If you never unmuted, just fine. You can continue to sit there in the global mute. And I'm going to start reading questions that have been typed up electronically from our online participants. Again, you can continue to type those up and submit them, and we'll continue to run through those in the remaining time that we have left for today's session. So the first question is coming in from the WDNR in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and they ask, if this is not discussed later, are filters disposable or are they rinsed, cleaned, and reused? I'm unclear if filters are a potential source as well. One cleaner that I'm working with historically hosed off his filters behind the machine and then rinsed the stuff down the sewer. Is that common practice?
Who wants to take that one? I will, if nobody else does.
Go for it, Bill.
All right. It depends on the solvent. Filters, cartridge filters, I assume that's what she's talking about, from a PCE dry cleaning operation or hazardous waste, typically, before they change those filters, they're supposed to let them drain for 24 hours if they're a standard cartridge filter, and if they're one of the ones with clay in it, they like to drain them for 48 hours just to get as much solvent back as they can. Even after they're drained, there's still a lot of solvent in it because the clay and the carbon, they sorb to that material. So if you set them out on the ground, you can get solvent that'll bleed out of there, and those need to be disposed as hazardous waste. Some of the dry cleaners recover still more solvent from those filters. The steam cabinet that Don showed you, some of them actually put them in there to recover solvent, and some of them put them in devices that are heated, and they recover solvent from them. We've had a couple that fessed up that they were rinsing them and rinsing the stuff down the drain, and that's illegal. It's been illegal since RCRA came in. Now, on the petroleum ones, they drain those, and the petroleum dry cleaners use a lot more, in general, a lot more cartridge filters. And I worked in RCRA for 2 years, and all RCRA is local. But if a flash point, you know, they have to characterize their waste. If the flash points for the Stoddard solvents, it's as low as 105. Some of that waste may be hazardous, but most of them, they let them drain it, and some of them say if they bag it, they can put it in the dumpster, but I hesitate to tell you that that's legal. Check with, you know, your record people. But, yeah, rinsing them out down the drain, that's a no-no, even the petroleum ones.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from SNC-Lavalin Environment in Ottawa, Canada, and this is a general question. They ask, is PCE distillation conducted using heat or a vacuum?
Most of the distillation is done using steam generated from the boiler, and I think when I made a statement in my presentation about vacuum, this is where the confusion comes in. The PCE perk boils at 250 degrees Fahrenheit, but the distillation temperatures usually run lower than that, because it's an azeotrope, because the water's in there, so they'll generally run them at about 190 degrees. The petroleum solvent, first of all, a lot of petroleum solvents do not, dry cleaners, do not distill. because petroleum solvent is a mixture. Stoddard's like over 200 different compounds, and the distillation temperatures are different for each of those compounds, and they're a lot higher. They can get up in the 340s degrees Fahrenheit. So they, if they have a distillation unit, it operates under a vacuum, because if you lower the pressure, you can lower the distillation temperature, and those typically operate about 100 degrees Fahrenheit, but they also are heated with steam. So that's where the vacuum comes in. Did that, well, I guess I can't ask him if that answers his question, but.
You certainly may, and if the individual did not get a complete response, you're welcome to submit a clarifying question or comment, and we'll address that in just a few moments. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next question online, and this is coming in from the Antia Group in Sylvania, Ohio, and they ask, if Stoddard solvent is a mixture of heavier hydrocarbons, how do regulators determine whether soils have been successfully remediated? What about groundwater? Is TPH used?
This will probably require an answer from each of us. What we run at a Stoddard solvent site, typical analytical suite, is we run a TPH method, which is a FL Pro, which is kind of unique to Florida. We run 8260 or 8021, and the reason we do is Stoddard will have up to 22-23% aromatics, so you'll see some of those in the fresh Stoddard. Most of it is C10 through C12, which is a longer chain. So we'll run some polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons like 8310, something like that, and we'll see some of those. But so our answer is based on all three of those. And the other thing you see at a petroleum operation, and they swear up and down that that's all they've ever used, you'll see chlorinated solvents at most of those, so that's the value in also running the 8260 or the 8021. And I'm sure the answer is probably different for the different states.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bill, that in Wisconsin we have a GRO, DRO method that we use instead of TPH, but otherwise the 8260, 8021 methods, and looking for some of these long-chain carbons are the primary method we use.
Let's say in Oregon, treated kind of like a UST fuel site in some ways. We would do a hydrocarbon identification, and then if it was determined to be Stoddard, then we would the cleanup decisions would be based on the toxicity, and we would have a risk-based concentrations for each of the individual constituents in the, let's say, like a 8270 pH analysis, or if there was BTEX constituents there or other kind of heavier end volatiles there, it would be based, the cleanup decisions would be based on the toxicity in our RBCs. I guess in some cases our cleanup program doesn't mandate the removal of free product. I would imagine in some states the issue of free product being Stoddard might dictate free product removal, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay. I'll move along to the next question, which is going to come in from the Alabama Department of Environmental Management in Montgomery, Alabama. And they ask, is the muck cleaned out of the equipment managed like a listed hazardous waste?
Depends on what solvent it is. On a PCE dry clean operation, now you can recover PERC from the muck by a distillation process, and that recovery is called, the waste product from that recovery is cooked powder residues. But and most of the PERC operators that use a powder filtration system will recover the solvent from the muck. A lot of petroleum dry cleaners, like I said, they don't do distillation, and many of them run a powder filtration system, and some of them don't recover the muck because they don't do any distillation. In their case, you'd have to characterize it, and I guess the thing that you'd look most for is ignitability, which is characteristic. But on the PERC side of it, the waste from the distillation process would be a hazardous waste, and we could get into the argument, is it listed or is it characteristic, but it's hazardous.
Okay. The next question is coming in from the Wisconsin DNR in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And this is a historical question. They ask, why is it or why was it decided to use solvents to clean clothes rather than water?
Well, I can take an initial stab at that, and then Bill can probably correct me if I'm wrong. But water is a solvent, obviously, the universal solvent. But I think it was kind of happenstance back in the day that they figured out that some of these products, these initially petroleum products, would be good for using. For cleaning clothes or fabrics, and then it just kind of evolved from there. And you know, the FCRD website has quite a list of some of the early products that were used, which were mainly lighter end petroleum hydrocarbons. So I don't know, Bill, do you have any more?
I just say, you know, greases and oils and things like that just don't respond well to soap and water. So the non-aqueous solvents are the degreasers. So that's the primary reason.
Okay. The next question comes in from the Mass DEP in Springfield, Massachusetts. They ask, do you always start assessment of sanitary sewer lines with hydrostatic testing? Please comment on the use of soil gas or other sampling techniques to identify sewer line contaminant sources where you may not have access for in-pipe tests.
Can you do that, Bill?
We tend to run a camera when we do that more than anything else. And you can get cameras that'll go in a 1-inch clean out, which is pretty small. Now, you may not see any leak with camera, and that's where the hydrostatic testing would be of value. And but the camera's a pretty good tool, and it's there's different sizes, and it's pretty cheap. You can get a plumber to come out there and run a camera for really cheap. The thing to remember when you run that camera is don't run it at peak hours when he's discharging wash water or your next door to a laundry, because it'll just look like the Great Flood and you won't see anything at all.
I would follow up. I think the question also asked about using soil gas surveys to evaluate sewer lines, and I would say, in my experience in Oregon and the West Coast, that certainly using direct push and soil gas along sewer lines for leaks can be used, especially if the groundwater is relatively shallow. And I think if you're collecting groundwater samples near a sewer and there was a problem, that higher levels in the groundwater would and or soil gas would help lead you to where there might be problems with the sewer line?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that also, that certainly in Wisconsin we do use soil gas surveys along soil lines, as well as taking soil samples to identify where the perchloroethylene has leaked along the sewer line.
And I think I'll jump in after Terry on that one, since you mentioned soil sampling, and I'm not sure if we got into that too much, but one thing to remember with dry cleaners, I've done a lot of sampling of soil at dry cleaners and got a lot of non-detects and found big problems in groundwater from those dry cleaners. So unlike a service station site, it's very likely you will not find the source area, at least initially, during your assessment. If you do not get contamination in soil, but you're seeing it in the groundwater at relatively high concentrations, it's probably from that site.
Okay, great. I have a clarifying comment that someone has submitted in reference to why someone would use solvents rather than water. And this is coming from the Wisconsin DOT in Madison, Wisconsin. And they state that other reasons for using solvents had to do with the fabric itself. Wool can shrink drastically when exposed to water, heat, and agitation. Wool suits could also become unwearable from standard laundering methods.
That's a good point.
Okay, so with that, I don't see it. Any other questions that have been submitted electronically regarding the technical presentation? And we have approximately 5 minutes left in the scheduled time. So with that, what I'd like to do is provide our speakers an opportunity to provide any closing comments or last-minute thoughts before I provide some final instructions on accessing slides, providing feedback, and getting confirmation for today's session and their participation. So let's start with our first presenter today. And I'm just going to start with, we'll start with Bill Lynn from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Bill, do you have any comments or closing statements?
I invite everybody to read the paper on assessing sites because it's got a lot more detail and it's well documented. And I urge everybody to visit our website. One of the things on the website is the members section, and so you can get on that, and our email addresses are on that. I think they're also on this presentation. So if you have any questions, contact us.
Okay, great. Don Hansen from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, any closing comments?
Not many. I guess just keep in mind regarding the process about the coin-operated sites that they are bad actors a lot of the time or were. The fact that if you have a facility that says they're only a drop store, that they may very likely have operated a dry cleaner there in the past. That's it.
Thank you. And Teresa Evanson from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Closing comments?
No, I don't think I really have anything to add. I'm glad, however, that we've had this opportunity to present this information. I think it really is important and an important issue across the whole country. So thank you very much.
Okay, great. And lastly, Steve Hoke from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection.
I just reemphasize what Bill says. The SCRD website is an amazing source of information, and just clicking on a bunch of items there, you can learn more than you could ever do on a webinar. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to the final slide in today's presentation material, which is slide number 97. On that slide, you should see two active hyperlinks. You may not, depending on the format that you're, if you're looking at the slides, as PDFs or in printed copies. Those of you who are looking at the slides online, you'll see a link to the additional resources page, which has other references or related links that have been discussed in today's session. So in particular, the Dry Cleaners Group's website is actually linked on the resources page. So I'd highly encourage you to take a look at that related or resources page and pull that up to review not only the PowerPoint materials that we covered today, but again, related resources that the organizers have put together. The other link that you'll find on slide number 97 is a link to our feedback form. We do ask that you take just a minute or two to complete the very short form that we have up online to let us know what you thought of today's session. If you enjoy participating in free online technical training like this, submitting feedback and letting us know that will help us to continue to improve deliveries in the future on CLUIN. For those of you that are participating and looking to receive credit for participating in today's session, if you have CEUs, PDHs, or you're looking to acquire those, we don't necessarily give them out for CLUIN Internet seminars. However, you may have luck earning them with materials we can provide to you from the CLUIN seminar. And one of those pieces of information, in addition to a registration confirmation email, which you should have received, and a copy of today's presentation slides, which you can get on the resources page, will also be a confirmation email that you'll receive upon completing feedback. When you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records that does verify that you participated and submitted feedback for the event at the end of the session today. If you are sharing the line with multiple participants and each person would like to get their own confirmation feedback, that's certainly possible. In fact, when one person submits feedback, there will be a link that appears on the following screen, which will allow the next person or someone else to submit their own feedback form. And they can put in their own email address and have their own confirmation message sent to them. With that, if you're having any problems accessing the links on slide number 97, they are all also available at the bottom of the seminar homepage. So when you registered for today's event, that very same page that you used to jump into the slides, if you look at the bottom of the seminar homepage, you will see links to download the materials, links to the resources page, as well as a link to the feedback form. So if you can't fill that form out now, you can certainly come back to it at a later time. And a final reminder, again, you will receive a follow-up email from me as soon as the recorded version of today's training is available for free replay and download. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, and as soon as you get that email, you'll be able to forward that along to any colleagues that you think will find this session to be informative. Those will be the final closing reminders and remarks for everyone. I just want to extend my thanks to all of our organizers who worked to put together today's session, in particular the State Coalition of Remediation of Dry Cleaners, and in particular our presenters who worked very diligently to prepare today's materials and deliver the session. And I also want to thank the over 450 participants that I know of right now, and we'll continue to clean up that headcount. I think we have more like 500 people on the line who took time out of their busy schedules to join us today. I hope that you found this session a useful expenditure of your time and that you'll continue to participate in free technical training through CLUIN in the future. With that, this is the formal conclusion of today's CLUIN Internet Seminar. I thank you and hope you have a good rest of your day.